Welcome to the Red Rain Podcast. Here is your host from Revenge of the Birds, Walter Mitchell.
Thank you, Kyle Little Rock Ledbetter. Boy, Cardinal fans, wow, what a game yesterday. That the Cardinals virtually dominated in so many ways, and it's just unbelievable to think that they lost that game. It was the one hope to avoid the worst record versus the NFC West in Cardinals franchise history. I had a feeling, I had tweeted out during the day, that this was the Cardinals' great chance to return the favor on Pete Carroll, who was essentially knocked out the three previous coaches, Wisenhunt, in light of the 58-0 loss in Seattle. That was the beginning of the end for him. Then Arians getting knocked out on week 17 of his best season of 2015, 36-6 whacking in Arizona, which took and added more injury to Carson Palmer. That was a really rough go there. And from there on, BA's, tenure in Arizona was on the decline. Then, of course, with Cliff in his best season, the 36-30 loss they pinned on the Cardinals in week 18, actually we're going 17 games then, cost the Cardinals the NFC West championship, and of course led to the Rams playoff debacle, having to play an away game instead of a home game as a division champion, and then the Kyler drama, and then we all know what happened from there. And I thought the Cardinals had a great chance to knock out Pete Carroll because, coming off last week against the Steelers, and the yards they gave up on the ground versus them, and if the Cardinals could do the same, I could see the Seahawks moving on from Pete. And he's been a longtime nemesis in our division. Would have been sweet. Instead, I just can't imagine how Pete Carroll came out of that game still smiling and winning. And it almost felt like the game was staged in so many ways. Look at these stats. First downs, Cardinals 24, Seahawks 18. Passing first downs, 11 for Cardinals, 8 for Seahawks. Rushing first downs, 13 for Cardinals, 9 for Seahawks. Total plays, 69 for Cardinals, 53 for Seahawks. Total yards, 466 for Cardinals, 327 for the Seahawks. Total drives, 9-9. Yards per play, 6.8 for Cardinals, 6.2 for Seahawks. Passing, 260 for Cardinals, 189 for Seahawks. Rushing, 206 for Cardinals, 138 for Seahawks. Unbelievable. And it's amazing to think the Cardinals were so dominant. Like Kyle has said all year, between the 20s, they make a lot of noise. But then, it's unthinkable to consider that at home with 466 yards of total offense, and with 36 minutes in time of possession to 23 for the Seahawks, the Cardinals only scored 20 points. It's just, and the last came on a trick play. When they got in the red zone earlier, the play calling in there, or the play execution, was just awful. And then the whole ending, it's just uncanny how it transpired. The Cardinals have a field goal to basically salt the game away. And, Matt Prater, who's been reliable all year, particularly from that distance, fades the ball too far to the right. And it just looked weird to me. I've never seen him sort of, you know, move his head around to see, like, is the kick going to be good? It just, the whole thing looked staged to me. That in itself, I was like, what? Are you kidding? And then to see, like, just, you know, it's like classic Cardinals house of cards. I mean, you build up this foundation in the whole game. And then, like, everything you could possibly want to do wrong practically happens, and the whole house of cards comes falling down. I mean, the Seahawks' response. I mean, four plays, 67 yards in 1 minute and two seconds. I mean, and look how easy it was. I mean, it's just preposterous. And Tyler Lockett, how many times is he going to be our nemesis? And not only that, okay, so Tyler Lockett beats the Cardinals zone over the top. There's no safety help. Starling Thomas, the fifth, chases him pretty well. Can't imagine why he didn't get a hand up to try to deflect the pass when he was right there next to Lockett. Didn't. Lockett catches the ball. It's now 20-19. Of course, the Seahawks now, who are out of the playoffs, are going to go for two. And of all people, you're going to leave wide open in the back end of the end zone. I mean, wide open. There wasn't anyone within 10 yards of him. It's Tyler Lockett for the two-point conversion. The Cardinals' pass rush on that play looked just so weak. I mean, this is the game on the line. And this is happened too often this season, is these blown coverages. And people say, well, they suck. They lack talent. No. Blown coverages are on the coaches. I mean, you have athletes there who can at least be in the vicinity and be well-trained to defend these plays. And when you leave guys wide open, how about Will Dissly earlier in the game, the tight end, who was in because Noah Font was injured? Wide open for a touchdown. How about the third and long where, you know, they were in one of those zones off of a corner blitz where the corner slips, falls down, and then you're in this zone and there is a gaping wide, like, 20 by 30 rectangle open middle where Geno Smith can throw into. I believe it was to Lockett there too. Easy, easy pass. I mean, just make it so easy. And then, but to the Cardinals' credit, I mean, Kyler Murray was coming down, you know, to try to win the game, and he made some conversions, but then there were, again, like it was versus the Bears in a two-minute drill, there was that one play where like 30 seconds came off the clock where he's up at the line, like changing cover. I mean, it's just uncanny. I mean, with the clock running down, and then he got some really good passes to Michael Wilson, and that was a real highlight. But then they play it ultra-conservative to just set up, you know, they don't try to make it more of a chip shot. They just run over to the left hash line, half hash mark, losing a yard, and set up this field goal. That, by the way, when you look at the field goal, it looks nothing like a Matt Prater kick. I mean, his kicks get high trajectory, and he's got a slight fade on the ball. So on the left hand, he likes the left hash mark because he can start it out at the left upright, and whatever fade will just come back through the middle of the goalposts. Instead, this is a flat ball coming out, a dud ball that just was like Buffalo Wild Wings off to the right. I mean, as if they're giant fans. And, you know, I mean, it makes you wonder. I mean, Matt Prater is one of the most skilled kickers in the NFL. This was the first time ever he hasn't missed a game winning. He was 23 for 23 in game winning field goals. And this was well within his range. It just makes you wonder if this was practiced. I mean, you know, it does. And so once again, we're supposed to be, okay, wow, Cardinals put up a good fight, but they lost. Let's celebrate that they were able to keep the fourth pick in the NFL draft. Oh, my gosh. And then, of course, on Twitter, I just was battling fans left and right who were saying it's the perfect loss. Wow. I'm saying to those fans, can you honestly look James Conner in the eyes and say that to him? Buda Baker, all the guys who left everything they had out there, Will Hernandez, can you? Dennis Gardeck, who was the only Cardinal yesterday to get even, you know, within a whisker of Geno Smith, which he did several times. Again, the Cardinals had zero sacks, which they've been zero for December and January, practically, on sacks. The sacks have stopped. And, you know, the Cardinals wind up, like I said, a historic worst 0-6 in the NFC West, having been outscored 184-98. Which is giving up over 30 points a game. I mean, at the way the beginning of the game started, you just thought Kenneth Walker, the third, was going to run wild the way Kyren Williams and Christian McCaffrey did against this defense. Fortunately, the Cardinals' ball control on offense helped keep that up, the Seahawks' offense off the field, and Walker seemed to be a little banged up and you know, the particularly if the Cardinals got the lead there, you know, the Seahawks were just going to pass. But then look how easy the passing was. Four plays, 65 yards for a TD over the top in that situation with under a minute left. It's just brutal. And then the two-point conversion, which, you know, I mean, any quarterback could just stand there and make, because there was absolutely no pressure. And it was like the parting of the seas. You know, the Seahawks drew everyone, all the defenders away from the middle. And there was Tyler Lockett standing all alone for a game-winning catch. Ugh. So frustrating. It's so frustrating to me that people are just so content about losing, particularly to an NFC West rival. And I don't know about you, but I'm just so sick and tired of seeing Pete Carroll running off the Cardinals field like a 16-year-old, giddy as a 16-year-old. It's just happened so often. And, you know, and then, it, you know, so here, but here's the narrative is, oh, how hard and, you know, the Cardinals play. And, you know, but there's something about this whole season that feels like it was, you know, a ruse. And, you know, I was just saying on Twitter today, I said, you know, Jonathan Gannon, I've never seen a coach lose 13 games and almost look satisfied after losses. And so nonplussed about losing. I mean, we saw, you know, Mike Vrabel this week get challenged by the Tennessee Press. And he, you know, went into a rant about how awful losing is. How, you know, you lose your sleep and you feel for your bleed for your players. You know, what a disparity from Gannon, who just shows up after games looking like, you know, everything's cool. Like he's playing with house money. Like it doesn't matter. You know, we're like supposed to lose or whatever. And then to hear like sportscasters for the Cardinals call him hard-nosed. I mean, that's the softest defense I've ever seen in Arizona. It's been woeful. 32 in DVOA, last in the league. 31 in most points allowed. 32 versus the run. And how many blown coverages have we seen this year of wide open? I mean, the Cardinals are a quarterback's dream come true, Cardinals defense. And everybody wants to say lack of talent. But when you piss away, when you put guys in the wrong positions, as they did with Zaven Collins, when you piss away a talent like Isaiah Simmons, I mean, hard nose would be, I'm going to work it out with this athlete. We're going to get the most out of him. When you put two undersized converted safeties as middle linebackers, when you have a Collins standing there on the edge making one or two tackles a game, it's a debacle. When you start Josh Woods for 11 games, I mean, Owen Popo in the last two games, where was he all year? I mean, we could have been building off him as a rookie. Instead, Josh Woods just overmatched there. And for 11 games, we had to watch that. On his side of the field was Marco Wilson, who was having his worst year as a pro. And we got to sit through that for 11 games. I mean, these are unacceptable. So you talk about talent. I mean, but it's a misuse. It's a gross misuse of talent. And it's also it's an indictment on the way they're coaching the players. You know, you always say coach's job is to put players in a position to succeed. And this is not something Gannon and Rouse did much all season long. And that's where, people say, well, a couple good additions on defense, they'll straighten out. I don't know. I mean, we haven't seen the kind of coaching it takes. I mean, it's one thing if you get beat doing the right things. But if you get beat leaving guys wide open or, you know, letting running backs go off on you, it makes you look foolish and it makes you look soft. And so to call Jonathan Gannon hard-nosed is just beyond the pale for me. I mean, he's a defensive-minded head coach. What kind of an impact did he make on that side of the ball this year? Very minimal. I mean, Myjai Sanders, cutting him, like everyone's saying, oh, that was a good move. Myjai Sanders in the Houston game had two rushes from the edge that got to Gardner Minshew, got him to throw the ball out early, that where he turned the edge twice better than I've seen from Zaven Collins all year. I mean, and we haven't seen Dimakije do it. I mean, the guys that are playing there, Cameron Thomas was a healthy scratch the last 2 weeks. I mean, what is going on here? And I'm sorry, but you know, all this buzz and myth about, oh, wow, well, Gannon's, you know, I'll tell you who the real star on this coaching staff is. It's Drew Petzing. I mean, imagine if he didn't do perform his magic with the offense, where we'd be right now. I mean, it's because of a ball control offense and how physically he had that offensive line playing and how inspired they were. I mean, the Cardinals' rushing attack is as good as it's ever been. Ever. I mean, James Conner, absolute stud. But James Conner is the culture setter. More than anyone in that building, except Buddha. I mean, with Conner on one side and Buddha on the other, you're made to order for any coaching staff. I mean, these guys are bell cow leaders. They're alpha leaders. And they played the same no matter who the coaches are. I mean, Conner got a Pro Bowl with Cliff. I mean, he was awesome in his first year. He had 20 touchdowns, I believe, something close to that. I mean, he's been the same since he arrived. Same with Buddha. They don't change. So if you want to attribute culture, those are the guys to attribute to. Gardeck, too. Gardeck is a culture guy. He gives it all he's got, on no matter what you ask him to do. So, but Petsing, I mean, we better hope some team doesn't get cute and want to get him in there right now with all of the teams that are wanting new quarterbacks and to draft new quarterbacks or develop the quarterbacks they have. Because this guy is a shining star. And I got to give a huge shout out to Kyle Little Rock Ledbetter for seeing that earlier than I did and recognize it. Well, actually, I saw the genius in what he was doing with the running game. What I didn't see was whether Kyler was the right kind of fit in this kind of offense. And what we've learned is, in many ways, he could be. They just got to score finish drives. I mean, which they're not doing. I mean, they're not scoring. They're put so much, like Kyle has nailed down too, is that they've been really good between the 20s and then kind of stalling out a lot and kicking field goals instead of scoring touchdowns. And with a guy like Trey McBride, you know, and Elijah Higgins, a big target in the red zone, Michael Wilson, a big target in the end zone, which Kyler hit in Philly for the huge touchdown. I mean, you've got options there with Connor out of the backfield, which, you know, Kyler hit him on in Philly. You know, these are things you got to, you know, rely on to score. And Connor's got as good a nose for the end zone as anyone in the NFL. So, you know, we got guys who should be able to finish. And that's pretty encouraging going into next year. And it's really encouraging that, you know, Kyler's come out of these games. I mean, he did more than enough to win yesterday, although I think he really could have put the game out earlier if he converted some of those field goals to touchdowns. But you know, he could have been 4-4 in this stretch. He's made good improvements. Still little shaky getting the snap off. I mean, some of those offsides, I'm sorry, they're on Kyler. They're not on the offensive line. It's just down to the last second every time. This is Kyler wherever he's, whoever he's coached for. And I can assure you, Drew Petsing has not coached him to do that. These, you know, waiting for the counts, waiting. He makes the players too anxious. Got to get the ball snapped. Got to get it snapped sooner. I think if they can play with a little better tempo, they're going to be even stronger next year. But Kyler's started throwing downfield more and connecting more, thank goodness, because that third and give up offense, which showed up again yesterday a few times, so galling. Was really hard to watch and see the Cardinals just come off the field without giving it as good a fight as they could. So, but that started to change. So that all is moving in a really good direction. And the question will be whether Kyler can take this momentum into next season and stay healthy. Cause that's the thing. And what was encouraging about this year is that he got two wins in December. Last week was December 2. So he got two wins in December, which had been rare for Kyler. Now, in other years, he was then playing in, he'd been playing all year and had been slowed by some injuries. So, but this is good. This is good that, he got two December wins and played well in those games. And he seems very focused. He says he's going to be working out today, a la JJ Watt. So, you know, that's, if there's one really positive development other than the physicality of the Cardinals offensive line and the running game with James Conner, It's that Kyler Murray is way more invested than he was last year. Feels way more a part of this thing. Called this team one of the most fun teams he's ever been on. Well, it's more fun when you're more invested. And Kyler this year was the first time he was invested from start to finish since his rookie year. COVID ruined OTAs for 2 years in there, and then Kyler ruined OTAs with his holdout in year four, and then was hurt during training camp, so he had no reps heading into the season. Without Hopkins on a PED violation, we know what happened from there. So that's where we are. There are some huge decisions that the Cardinals need to make. Before I turn to that, I want to get Kyle's take on what he saw yesterday and what he sees in general. Kyle?
Well, yeah. So to your point about petsing, like the thing that I said that I think you're giving me maybe more credit than I feel I deserve, but I appreciate the support, is that like petsing has very much earned a second and potentially a third season to work out some of the dynamics, because some of the stuff they were doing on offense was more creative than we've seen in the Kyler Murray era, especially the second year that he was there. I would like for them to run some more RPOs. I would like for them to run some more bootleg type of plays. I'd love for them to have more motion involved in their offense, like just because Petsing comes from a mold of offense that runs less motion doesn't mean he shouldn't adjust based on the personnel he has. And if you could get Greg Dortch moving in motion, if you could get even Trey McBride getting in motion from potentially the outside to the slot and play him the way that Kansas City runs Kelce, or you've seen the Lions run with Sam Laporta, I think that would be awesome. I think that they've had a lot of success this year on offense. It's been a step in the right direction. And granted, at the time, it looked like there might be some coaching changes, or Gannon would be a one and done. I don't think that's going to be the case anymore. So just kind of looking at it and thinking, well, Petsing should definitely be back next year because the strides the offense has made from the beginning, even when it was, in essence, third string quarterback in Josh Dobbs, was very nice. Right. So, yeah, in that sense, they've done some creative stuff. It looks different than it's been before, and it'd be awesome for them to have another season together just to work out the reps, because they have only played, you know, six games with a fully healthy offense.
Right. And you know, the question for me all along was offensive fit for Kyler. It's just the fit. Mm-hmm. And I've always envisioned Kyler at his best in an up-tempo spread where he's always had his greatest success.
Well, yeah. And one of the things that's interesting is the entire NFL is moving away from up-tempo spread offenses, and that's just kind of an interesting change in the league these last 2 years. I mean, everyone has changed to the game theory idea of, if we just run fewer plays, we are in more control of the game. And so everyone's, you know, just sitting on first down, running 40 seconds off the clock. I've seen so many 8-minute field goal drives this year, and I used to think that, you know, Vic Fangio's offenses were archaic because they were getting 8-minute field goal drives with the Broncos, and now everyone's running 8-minute field goal drives. So it's just a different league than it was 2 years ago, and it's okay to switch up your offensive principles and slow things down a bit on offense, because everyone's doing that. Everyone wants to control time of possession, which, it's funny that you mentioned that now, because that was going to lead me into the other point that I was going to bring up, which is, This is the game that you would want to have for the Cardinals. They outgained Seattle. They ran, I think, 16 more plays than the Seahawks. They had 12 more minutes of time of possession versus Seattle, and they were pretty much the better team all the way through. And then at the end, they didn't get the result they wanted, and the Seahawks won a fluky 1-point game. And if you are going to be the person who articulates for good loss and draft positioning, this is the game that you would make the argument, but I don't think the trade-offs were really worth it, because it wasn't like that year that the Eagles sat everyone the last game of the season to jump from like pick 11 to pick 6 to get, or I think they traded back and got a first round pick out of it. But this, they would have jumped one spot in the draft if they had beaten the Seahawks. Thanks to the Titans winning and the Giants winning, they would have gone from 4 to 5. I don't really think the Chargers are in the Marvin Harrison Jr. market at this point. So I don't think it would have really made much of a difference if they had won or lost that game in the grand scheme of things. They would have basically had the exact same draft position. I mean, in the second, third, and fourth rounds, the difference between pick 4 and 5 is negligible. The only difference is this one at the top of the draft. And I don't think the difference between 4 or 5 really made much of a difference in the end. So it would have been nice for them to have won. You were articulating all year, it's good to have wins in your pocket going into next season. I mean, we saw what that did for the Lions last year. We saw what I think it'll do for the Bears this year with them going, you know, essentially 6-1 for 7 weeks and from November into December. So I think the win would have done them good, and the draft positioning wouldn't have really made much of a difference. I mean, it would have been, if it were 7-4, maybe I'd hear those people out a little bit more, but the difference between 5 and 4 is totally negligible.
Well, the object dart, object of apple of people's eyes are Marvin Harrison Jr. And so the further, you know, the Cardinals got away from where the quarterbacks were going to be taken, thinking that MHJ is going to be, you know, the first non-quarterback taken in the draft. That's where they were getting antsy. And but I agree with you. I mean, I think that there's still a possibility that quarterbacks can go 1, 2, 3, 4 in this draft because of the how talented the high-end quarterbacks are. I mean, if Michael Penix has a big night tonight, I think he's going top 10. I really do. I mean,
I would be surprised, but it's possible.
Who throws a better deep ball anywhere? I mean, he is just uncanny. They're now calling it down 30-yard downfield handoffs. That's how accurate he is. It's just unbelievable. The thing with him is his injury history. But he's held up well the last 2 years in Washington. And, you know, wow. I mean, he's a major league talent. But you also have Jaden Daniels making a strong surge. And I think he might sneak in there ahead of Drake May.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of the draft people I see and kind of lean on have said it's a 3-quarterback class at the top. And then, you know, someone might talk themselves into Bo Nix or talk themselves into Michael Penix in the first round, but it's, I guess, more likely that those two will be second round picks. But you're right, it could change. I mean, people didn't think Richardson would be part of the quarterback class last year, and then he went in the first round and Levis fell to round 2. So yeah, stuff could change. But most of the people I've heard have said it's a 3-quarterback class, and then, you know, Penix might be late first round or Bo Nix might be late first round if a team really thinks that they can develop one of those guys.
Well, yeah, and you haven't even mentioned a guy who tonight could change everything, J.J. McCarthy. Because, I mean, I was reading a report where the Raiders are making a strong push to sign Jim Harbaugh as head coach, and in which case Harbaugh has, by rumor, reportedly indicated that if he takes that job, he wants J.J. McCarthy with him. And they're in a position, I think the Raiders are 11th in the, or 13th. They're somewhere in the early teens, or, you know, 11 to 12, 13. If you could look that up to see where, I think because they won again yesterday, I think they're up to 13.
Yes, the Raiders have the 13th pick, yes.
Yeah. That may behoove them to, they could end up being a trading partner with the Cardinals if Marvin Harrison is off the board. And I have a feeling, anyway, all this clamoring about Marvin Harrison, That's all we heard last year was Will Anderson getting memes on Twitter with Will Anderson in Cardinal uniforms. Didn't happen. And I think there's a strong reason to believe that even with Marvin Harrison Jr., if the Cardinals are overwhelmed by an offer to get more draft capital, I think there's a strong chance they'll take it. And it's going to disappoint. I mean, if they pass on Marvin Harrison, it's going to disappoint some fans. But it was interesting last year how quickly fans pivoted away from Will Anderson once they saw the haul that Monty Ossenfort got from the Texans. And then they were like, oh, wow, this is incredible. So I think, people are impressed with that kind of haul. And the Cardinals caught it on camera so they could show everybody, which makes me nervous because I don't think that's good karma or can create good karma, particularly with other teams who would look at that and go, I don't want to be caught on tape with these guys. But it doesn't matter because if the Cardinals are in a position where one of those great quarterbacks is still sitting there, the phones are going to be ringing big time and the Cardinals are going to be listening. They're not going to turn down an opportunity to talk. So, I mean, some would think that pick four would be too high for J.J. McCarthy, but wouldn't be for Harbaugh, who loves the guy and thinks he can win with him because he's won with him at Michigan for 2 years. It's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out. And so there are big decisions that await. And I want to start with the front office, with Dave Sears, the assistant GM, with now all these GM openings popping up. There are going to be quite a few. I'm worried about Dave Sears getting tabbed. And I've been saying this for weeks now, and I'll just reiterate it, that the move that makes utter sense to me is promoting Monty Ossenfort to VP or team president, actually. Team president and Dave Sears to GM. That solves that. And it won't be as if Monty's doing anything different. I mean, Dave Sears has been sort of in charge of the draft anyway, and they'd just be working in tandem like they've been doing this whole year. That would really excite me. And I think that Dave Sears' track record in the draft is much stronger than Monty's. And that is a huge factor to me as well. I mean, Monty tends to take risks on players with medical red flags. And, first rounders with risks on that. And then later rounders, as he did with the Cardinals. And all three of their day two picks last year had medical red flags. Ojulari, and he knew going in two of them wouldn't even be ready for training camp, which is weird when you didn't do much in free agency for your defense and you could be relying on rookies. And then you cancel rookie minicamp, which is also bizarre, when it could have been a golden opportunity to induct your rookies even and assimilate them quicker and better. I love Dave Sears. I mean, if it had to come push or shove, I'd take Sears over Monty. But I don't want to have to make that decision. And Michael Bidwell, if he's, can understand the value of Dave Sears and in tandem with Monty as a dream team, then you can justify doing that and getting that done. So that's from the front office standpoint. And the more that, Michael Bidwell takes a back seat and let the front office guys do their thing, the better off we're going to be. I mean, someone on Twitter has been asking us to rate and grade certain people in the Cardinals organization. When he asked about Ossenfort and what grade you would give him, My tweet in return was, it's hard to know, it's hard to assess Monty entirely to know whether some of the decisions were really not his and they were Bidwell's instead. Like, to, you know, and I made the argument that no, I mean, when Monty was hired, it was clear, you know, no candidate the Cardinals interviewed was had a combination of being better qualified with head coaching experience and being automatically aligned in the Patriots way with Monty Ossenfort than Brian Flores. I mean, I still can't fathom why the Cardinals twiddled their thumbs with Flores, except that Bidwell, I think, vetoed it. I would imagine he would have, you know, maybe because of the Steve Wilkes situation, maybe because of the lawsuit, who knows? But, and maybe, you know, Monty's first year GM was compliant. And I, who knows? I mean, you would assume that, you know, here's the other thing about Flores, which I loved, was his last year in Miami. He went 3-1 versus the NFC West and took out Jared Goff and the Rams' patented off-tackle play better than anyone I've ever seen against Sean McVay. That game was the beginning of the end of Jared Goff in L.A. I mean, they stifled Goff so much. I mean, this was with his Dolphins defense, which was good, but not, you know, he didn't have elite talent. He had good cornerbacks and a couple good guys in the front seven, but it wasn't an elite personnel per se. But he, wow, and got a great game out of Van Ginkle in that game. And so, I mean, the track record of what he did, and then he shut down Shanahan's offense. The fact that he had done that before, and he schemed away, made an adjustment versus the Cardinals to beat Kyler in Tua's first start, 2-1. Some guy came back and to say, well, he screwed things up with Tua, so why would we ever want him? And I said, boy, if going 7-3 with Tua is screwing things up as a rookie, I mean, should screw up more often. You know, there's, again, these myths that go on that, like, you know, about certain players and certain coaches. But, you know, Flores was just such a natural fit. And I can tell you this right now. If Flores had been the head coach, there is no way we're getting our lunch handed to us on defense against all the NFC West teams the way we did this year. That was embarrassing. I mean, the way Kyron Williams went off on us twice, Christian McCaffrey twice, Kenneth Walker, good thing yesterday the game sort of didn't dictate him carrying it more, and perhaps his own injury. But Zach Charbonnet came in and was getting 6.4 a carry. You know, it just, they gave up 5.5 average on 25 carries yesterday. But fortunately, the game didn't evolve that way. But otherwise, we've seen Walker dominate on us too often already. So, I mean, we got to get a defensive stud in there. So I'm just going to go for the defense right now, is that I thought it was a huge mistake from the beginning that, you know, if Gannon was going to not call defense and run the defense, which he insisted as a provision of him being hired, then I thought it behooved him to, okay, if you want to do that, well, then get somebody with experience, like a Mike Zimmer, who he's very close to. You know, even if you want to name Nick Rouse the coordinator, you could have a defensive advisor helping with game planning and this and that. That could have been huge. But there's a scenario now that would make a ton of sense if it happens, and that's with the Bears and Ryan Poles as GM. If he elects to move on from Matt Eberflus, whom Gannon played with, you know, had was coaches with on the Indianapolis staff, I mean the Minnesota staff. I mean, no, it was the Indianapolis staff, excuse me. You know, that could be, wow, hire Eberflus as the assistant head coach. You can keep Rouse as a coordinator, and the two of them working together, and Eberflus could be up in the booth calling down the signals to Rouse. It could be a really good team there. Eberflus is an accomplished defensive head, a defensive-minded coach that could add texture and better preparation. And Eberflus is talking about someone who holds players accountable. He keeps charts to hold them accountable. I mean, that would be, I think, a really great move if he gets fired from the Bears. And I don't see him being a head coaching candidate, at least for, you know, he'll have to bounce back having success somewhere else again before he's considered, probably, you know, on the defensive side of the ball. We need help there. That would be great. I mean, and maybe he takes some of those Bears free agents away on defense that he, you know, he's worked with, including the cornerback Johnson, but I think they might franchise tag him. But that would be a move to make there. Something should be done there. I fear that Gannon has the kind of hubris to think that they've got it covered when there's just so many mistakes on defense this year as a result of coaching. Yes, the talent wasn't elite like he had in Philadelphia, but like I said, it was a misuse of the talent he had in certain ways, and then a poor accountability on pass coverages, something that you can do with accountable players, of them being in the right spots and being coached to do the right things, which wasn't happening consistently well. And then again, you're going to need to rethink your how you're going to defend with linebackers up the middle, because that tandem they had last year was way overwhelmed physically to do it. And both ended up injured and out for the year. So, you know, something's got to give there. I hope, hopefully, they'll be wise enough to move Zaven back to middle. If not, I think it behooves you probably to trade Zaven to a team that wants to play him where he's most naturally suited. And again, this just really upsets me with, you know, Cardinals. You know, everyone says that Steve Keim's draft picks suck. Let me say this. The draft picks didn't suck. The coaching of them sucked. Okay? Everybody who gets a first-round grade in the NFL doesn't suck. The difference is how you coach them up, how well you groom them, and how confident you make them. And how fluent you make them in your system. We saw how Isaiah Simmons and Zaven Collins were yo-yoed by Vance Joseph. We saw that. It wasn't good for either one of their confidences. You know, they were yanked around, yanked out of games. I mean, they didn't get the Kyler treatment where it's all in, put it that way. And if it had been, I think you're looking at two completely different players right now. There's no doubt in my mind. So, you know, there's something, you know, and Monty Osifor comes from a, you know, organization that prides itself in defense in both the Patriots and the Titans. I'll be interested to see how Monty becomes an architect of trying to rebuild this defense. And how, what kind of help they can get from another coach to bring in to help out and to somehow get on top of bread and butter plays in the NFC West to begin with, which Gannon and Rouse had very little answers for. And it was really mind-boggling to see that given, you know, this is their new division. So, that's on the defensive end. On the offensive end, yes, adding to the wide receiver position. I don't think that, or receivers in general, I think you're just you basically have almost everybody coming back. Your starting quarterback's coming back. Your backup in Clayton Tune. They'll probably add someone to the mix there, either a draft pick or some veteran. I mean, look at Driscoll yesterday throwing for the Browns. He threw two touchdowns in the second half. They might bring Driscoll back. You know, that might be a fit, and keep Tune as the QB2. Tune's done a nice job coming in on the tush pushes and getting those things done. I'm impressed with him. And it's too bad we never got a really honest look for him. I mean, that Browns game was like sending a guy out in a bullfight without a lance or a shield. So I don't think fair at all to judge him off of that one game. It was just such a poor setup. But look, I mean, you've got, I think regardless of whether DJ Humphreys was injured or not, I think there has been a plan to get a new left tackle or right tackle and move Paris back over to the left side where many of us thought he belonged in the first place. And then you got Hernandez and Froholt and Cologne coming back. You got John Gaines coming back healthy next year. Could be a factor in there. You've got some Carter O'Connell, could be a swing tackle. You got Kelvin Beecham. He was on a 2-year deal, so he should be back. I mean, I think that you're going to see the Cardinals add a tackle, if not on day one, sometime on day two, to the mix there. I think they're very keen on the top two tackles, Olu Fashanu and Joe Alt. I think of the two, sort of knowing Dave Sears, I think he'd go with Alt. Because Alt's better versus the run. And maybe not as supremely athletic as Olu in pass pro, but he's really good. I mean, he's fundamentally sound, and he's 6'9". I mean, and he's got good feet. So I could see them leaning towards Alt in that regard. So I think a tackle. And then you got mid-range tackles in that first round or early ones in second round that could make sense as well. So I think they're going to address the tackle situation in the draft unless there's somebody in pre-agency they really, really like. Or if they make a trade for a tackle, which is always possible. But then you got your running back room with Connor, Carter, and Emercado, 1, 2, 3. That's really good, great shape. You probably added a running back in day three somewhere. Then your tight end group, with McBride, and look at how Higgins came on as a receiver. And then Kolek, the kid that they picked up from the Titans. From the Ravens. That kid, wow, he's a potential mauler in there. He's big and physical. I like him. And then Blake Whitehart is, you know, the next receiver behind Higgins. So you've got some depth there and some interesting young talent, very interesting young talent, you know, that it's not an immediate need. Also, I mean, Marquise Hayes as a guard, you know, maybe a year stronger. I mean, I've always liked him. I think he could fit in well. He's got to lose a little weight to, you know, be to pull and trap the way that the Cardinal offensive line does, but you know, he could be an interesting factor in there. And there's a lot of offensive line. I mean, Hayden Howerton's been saved on the IR. I think he's in ER free agency that they should be able to keep in the mix. Really like the the center Ishmael they got from backup center guard Steve Ishmael that they picked up. He should still be in the mix. I think they still have a year with him. So there's a lot of depth there of guys that are pretty solid. And, you know, with four of the five starters, well, and then Wilkinson came on at the end. Cologne, I think, played better, and he's coming back. So I don't know if they'd re-sign Wilkinson. I don't know about Dennis Daly. I'm not sure about that. I think they probably are going to move on from those guys, but or take them back at the minimum or something or close to. So because you can never have enough depth, right? So that looks like, you know, one or two pieces to add up on the offensive line. Maybe a tight end. It's the kid Sennett from Kansas State I really like a lot. You know, you might see a day three tight end. That might be good. And then, you know, at wide receiver, I think you're going to see them add to a free agent. Now, Marquise Brown, if he wants to do a prove it deal with great incentives, that would be great. That'd be wonderful. That's the solution. If he wants to just test the market and get as much money as he can now, then so be it. I don't think he's going to get that from the Cardinals, nor should he, based on the last two seasons of injuries. So, and he's got to show that, you know, but we'd love to, I mean, it'd be great to keep him. If you can do it, whereas it's a win-win with incentives for him and the Cardinals, make an incentivized deal. Rondale Moore's back. Greg Dortch is back. I mean, he too is under control according to Howard Balzer, because he only has two accrued seasons. He needs three to be a UFA. So next year he'd be here in 2025. So he's back. And then you got Wilson coming back. So a big receiver, wide receiver one would be awesome. And if you keep Marquise Brown, there you go. And I like some of those guys that they had. Caden Davis is a slot guy that's really good. I think could be a good contributor if Dortch ever went down or whatever, because he returns punts too. And then the kid Arias, the big kid from Colorado, I really liked him. So there's some depth there too. And Bacelia, who's, you know, had a really good preseason again last year and then got nicked up. But so there's some depth there. So on offense, you're really only a few pieces away. On defense, you're a number of pieces away. And I think position shifts away from, and better coaching away from get to being, you know, to having a defense that can, you know, reverse the tide in the NFC West. That's where
it sounds like we're rebuilding a defense from scratch. Everything is on the table.
Well, yeah. I mean, it depends on if you say, okay, Zabin, we're moving you back to Mike, and we're sliding, Kaiser White over to Will, where he played well in Philadelphia. That settles that. And then you got Popo backing up. And I love the kid that they got in waivers, the inside linebacker. I'm drawing a blank in a second on his name. Come on, Mitch. Slowick. I'd have to look it up again. I did some research on him and wrote an article about him, or wrote him up in an article where I was just so impressed with what I saw with him on tape. And it was amazing to me that he got waived. So let me just check this for a second, because I know I have it right here. And the pressure of the moment's getting to me, where I'm like forgetting the kid's name. because they had so many additions. I mean, so many of these guys. So I wrote this article, said where Asa Fort and Sears and the pro personnel team deserve very high praise. This was a well commented on article where we took some polls, you know, of like, what grade would you give them for the young additions? I mean, here are the ones that stood out to me, all right, that I think have a really good chance of making the roster. These were additions that weren't draft picks. I think all the Cardinals draft picks coming back have a really good shot. But here are the ones that stood out to me. As a running back two, Michael Carter. As running back three, Amari DiMeccardo. Travis Vokolek, tight end three. You know, maybe Blake Whitehart, and he battled it out for tight end three. But if you want a receiver, it's Whitehart. If you want a blocker, it's Vokolek. And seeing as Higgins is a receiver, I could see Vokolek getting the tight end three. And I could also see them keeping four because of the way that they love to run 12 and 13 personnel. Tristan Colon in mix for left guard. Well, I thought he was the most effective, consistent player there. So he could be in the mix for left guard one and could be an automatic swing guard tackle because he plays guard center. Carter O'Donnell, swing tackle. Roy Lopez, DT1. I think he starts next year. This kid is a good, solid player. If not, he's in the rotation for sure. Now, here it is. Trevor Nowaski, middle linebacker too, I think. You know, that kid is a baller. I mean, he reminds me of Gardeck, only he's a bigger, stronger version of Gardeck, and he can play inside. And, this was a kid who, you know, that the Lions signed. High-end talent. For small school player, and he had played a few special teams with them and done well. So Starling Thomas, the fifth, cornerback four, maybe. I'll add another guy in here who the Cardinals secretly stashed away in the moves this week, is Devaud Wilson, the cornerback, young quarterback, they claim. He got some really good minutes earlier, a few games back. And yesterday they elevate him to the 53-man roster and then didn't activate him for the game. So why did you do that? Well, here's why. Is that in 2 days on January 10th at 4 p.m., all practice squad players are eligible to be claimed by playoff teams. So if you wanted to protect a player, you got to get him on the roster. And that's why the Cardinals signed Ben Still and Devaud Wilson to the active roster so that, you know, they wouldn't get poached. So, and that's when they let Kevin Strong go, which I think was, Strong's been battling a knee injury and he wasn't going to be able to play this week. So cutting him or putting him in the IR, it's a moot point. What doesn't make it moot is the chance that Strong could catch on with a playoff team since he's a free agent now. But I think the Cardinals like Strong enough that they're going to try to bring him back. He made the biggest tackle of the year in that Bears game. In the Steeler win on the goal line versus Najee Harris, that was the best tackle of the year. That was awesome. And man, did he finish that. And then the two young safeties, Joey Blount emerged as one of our star special teamers, but also the chances he had to play free safety looked really good. And then Quantrez Knight, they didn't play much, but man, I talked with 49er fans who really loved this kid in preseason last year. He can play the slot in coverage, and he's a tackler, so we might get a good long look at him as for the potential to be strong safety too next year. And then the long snapper, Matt Hembro, who's been on the IR all year. And the Cardinals love his talent. If Aaron Brewer retires, if not, I think they think they probably bring Aaron Brewer back. And as I say, these are legit young talents. And I think this is why Austin Fortin Sears and the pro personnel team deserve major credit, you know, to work at the back end of the roster this way, to have this kind of young talent to bring with you for next year. They're all under contract, and the Cardinals have control on these guys, and you know, maybe the rebuild isn't going to be as daunting as people might suggest. All right, so and then special teams. I still wonder about Prater, whether he was given a bonus or something. I mean, I can't imagine him missing two kicks like that in the manner in which he missed them too. He's always an adjuster too, to kick the second one with almost a slice this time was just, plus it didn't have his normal trajectory. It just, something was bizarre about that, but I think he's under contract, so you know they're not going to move away from him. Aaron Brewer is a free agent. I think if he wants to come back, they'll sign him. And then Blake Gilligan's Island. Man, what a great year from him. And I'll just add in a joke here. I hope this makes some of you laugh. Wouldn't it have been so classic Cardinals if on that fake field goal, they flanked out Gilligan and Matt Prater the way they did, and then had Kyler throw a wide receiver bubble screen to Gilligan with Prater blocking? Wouldn't you want to pay to see that? Wouldn't that have been so Cardinals to do?
I would have gotten a laugh out of it.
Talk about third and give up. This would have been fourth and give up. Oh my gosh. Fortunately, what was so close on the snap, they were like statues. They didn't even move a step.
But they wouldn't have gotten an eligible man downfield. If you throw the screen and he catches it, and then he runs with five blockers behind him, you know?
Yeah, and they were both perfectly eligible. I mean, Gilkin was in the slot, and Prater was onside. On the line, as the eligible wide receiver, online receiver, didn't do a Tony and have a, you know, be offside.
Mm-hmm.
That was a play that actually Pete Carroll had a good reason to criticize the refs because the Cardinals made a substitution. The Seahawks should have been given the right to do the same, and. But Pete could, and I don't know if he did try to call a timeout and wasn't, cause the Cardinals got it off pretty quickly. So, you know, I don't know if that happened even, he was arguing that too. He's trying to call a timeout, but he could have called a timeout. And if he was correct, he would have gotten that timeout back. And I think he was correct. But still, it was a great play by Jeff Rogers, and Kyler said he'd been trying to do this for 5 years. That's awesome, Kyler. That was very funny. And man, perfect execution. Trey McBride, perfect throw, perfect spot, back into the end zone. Ba-boom. But to think that was the only passing touchdown of the day was disappointing, given the opportunities the Cardinals had. And But that is that, and here is here, and now is now. Focus on what the Cardinals can do to improve themselves, personnel-wise, coaching-wise, administrative-wise, heading in. I mean, it's going to be ongoing dialogue. Kyle, your concluding thoughts?
I think you set next week as the deadline for me to put together my plan, my jumping off the fence and putting together a plan for the Cardinals off season. So I will come prepared with that for next week's episode of Red Woo-hoo! Rain.
Yeah, baby. Oh man, I'm looking forward to that now. And I will be doing the same. So we'll match wits on that. We'll make that the focus of next week, the off season plans. With Little Rock and mine, and we'll compare and contrast. We have currently 52.2 million over the cap. I mean, under the cap. So we got some little cash to work with there, but there are other moves that can be made to free up more money. So I'm sure as a future budding GM, you'll find those players.
it depends. Is Michael Bidwell willing to divvy up cash as signing bonus instead of putting it to the contract?
Yeah, well, when you're persuasive way, you're going to have to convince them of that. So I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt that you can. So if you want to hear your plan unfettered and straight out, what you see the Cardinals should do and could do, makes it really fun. So with that, enjoy the playoffs. Enjoy tonight's game. Can't wait. Michigan, Washington. A lot of players on both sides. There could be a really great potential interest to the Cardinals in their draft and to all the teams in the NFL. So quite a talent display on both sides of the ball for both teams tonight.
And while we were recording, Jordan Schultz put out that it looks like for the Raiders, it's down to Harbaugh or Antonio Pierce. Those seem to be the two options for the Raiders at this point. So we'll see how tonight's result plays a factor in deciding that outcome and the direction of that team.
Yeah, and the other rumor is the Chargers are heavy on Harbaugh too. So, that's going to be very interesting to see if. I think this is the year Harbaugh's going to make the jump back. So I'd be surprised if it isn't. And he's got two real heavy suitors going right now. So enjoy next week playoffs, coming back for the off-season plan show number one with Little Rock and myself for next week. Wish you all well. And another year in the books. Going to miss it. Feel like a long year to have this, to watch our team again, but we'll get, we'll talk about every step of the way, and it's going to be an interesting ride with all those draft picks, 11 of them, and the cap money, and let's see, will the Cardinals be able to attract some good free agents? Have they done enough to kind of create a buzz about themselves to enable that? I think the Cardinals players, core players, are going to have to do a little bit of recruiting on their ends, but to enable that. But it should be fun and interesting. And in the interim, may the red, red rain shower down on you into the red, red sea, as it was almost doing yesterday, so sweetly, ever so sweetly. And thank you, and to all the fans who stuck through the Cardinals all year long, the ones who went to the games and cheered them on. You are the lifeblood of the Red Sea, and can't appreciate you more. Red Rain.